Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. On our way to our conversation, of course, we will go through our day in history on this August the 27th, which was the day before the march on Washington. I don't know if you all just listened to Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! We'll give a little reprise of that tomorrow on the 50th anniversary, actually, of that day in Washington, D.C. And hearing Gloria Richardson's voice was amazing. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. She was leader of the movement in Cambridge. I went to jail with her more than once. She was an amazing human being, still is at 91, hasn't lost her fire. I loved listening to that. That was great. On this day, August 27th, what happened on this day? On this day, speaking of the march in Washington, in 1963, this evening, W.E.B. Du Bois died in Accra, Ghana. W.E.B. Du Bois, of course, was one of the great leaders of this country, founder of the NAACP, author of many, many books and novels and essays. He was a fighter for social justice, became a member of the Communist Party, never stopped fighting for human rights to the end of his last breath, left this country because of racism, being hounded. He was a man who wrote The Souls of Black Folk and many very important books. And was a fighter always, who was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and he died at 83 years old in 1970. I mean, died at 99 in 1963. An amazing human being, W.E.B. Du Bois. We remember him on this day, and we'll maybe play some of the broadcasts of our interviews about him in the coming days. This is also the day in 1975. That's where I got the 75 by making a mistake. That Haile Selassie died. The Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, who died at the age of 83. He was overthrown by a revolutionary movement. Before that, he's famous for many things. He tried to modernize Ethiopia. He was a man revered by many across the world. And in 1936, the Italians invaded Ethiopia on the verge of World War II. And when they did, Haile Selassie was forced to flee the country. But he snuck back in, and he led a guerrilla army that fought the Italians and the Nazis in Ethiopia to liberate his own country, which was the oldest independent black nation on the planet Earth. So when he was overthrown, a lot of land ownership and class issues and poverty issues that faced Ethiopians, that coup led to the close of the oldest monarchy extant on the Earth, the Makeda Solomonic Monarchy that claims to have gone back 3,000 years. So on this day, he died. This is the day in 1637. A founder of the state of Maryland, Baltimore City, the third Baron of Baltimore, Charles Calvert, was born in 1637. He was also a slave owner. Let me throw that in so we don't forget that. This is the day that Rose McClendon was born in 1884. Most of us don't know who she was, but during the 1920s and 30s, she was one of the great stage actresses in America, unknown because she was African-American, except in certain circles. She was an award-winning actress, created on theater companies, was an amazing spirit and part of the whole world of Langston Hughes and Paul Robeson and more during that period. This is the day in 1908, talking about the civil rights movement, that Lyndon Johnson was born, a man who may have started out with a segregationist past in many ways but became the president that actually signed the laws that ended segregation, put voting rights into effect and more, a very complex figure, born on this day in 1908. This was the day in 1832 that Black Hawk was captured in the United States, leader of the Sauk Nation of Native Americans, who led the Black Hawk War, fought with the British against the Americans, refused to give up Indian land. When he was captured, he was actually paraded around the nation, literally people jeering at him, throwing things at him, kind of as a mocked figure. He died in Iowa. He was a very famous figure in American history. This is the day in 1859 that petroleum was first discovered in Titusville, Pennsylvania. It was the first commercially successful oil well. And the saga begins. And this is the day in something we don't think about, little things like this. 1918, the Battle of Ambos Nogales. It was the only battle fought in World War I in the Western Hemisphere, between Mexicans who were backed by Germans who fought the Americans. It was the only battle fought here on American soil, and that took place in 1918. This is the day in 1949 that the great Paul Robeson was scheduled to sing at Lakeland Picnic Grounds in Westchester County, New York, was disrupted by a mob of angry people, angry white people who did not like who Robeson was, what he stood for, and battles ensued. There's a very famous news piece at that time on this day in 1949. This is also the day that Harry Truman, who was president of the United States in 1949, seized all the railroads to prevent a general strike and didn't give them back to their owners until a year later. This is the day that the 1991 Central Life Insurance Company, the last surviving African-American-owned insurance company in the state of Florida, was ordered liquidated by a Florida circuit judge. And this was the day that President George Bush, in 1992, declared a no-fly zone over Iraq. And on this day, that is this day in history, August the 27th. Now we turn to today in our living history and what's going on in our community. We are joined here in studio by Walter Lomax, former prisoner who was exonerated after serving many years in prison and leads organizations. I'm sorry, Walter, what's the name of the organization?
Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative.
That wasn't on my sheet. I'm sorry. I'll make sure I have that right. Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative. And who is joins us in the studio along with Mike Milliman, who is the Jacob A. France Professor of Public Interest Law and Director of Leadership, Ethics, and Democracy Initiative at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Mike, good to have you in the studio.
Glad to be here.
And by phone, we have Russell Butler, Executive Director of Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center. Russell, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark.
And you all are welcome to the show at 410-319-8888. You can join us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. But Mike, as I said, we're going to open the show with letting you all kind of explain what happened here and then get into a discussion with all of our listeners and with Russell about this larger context. So both of you have fought for this for a while, but take us back to the Court of Appeals. What exactly happened? Why are almost 200 men serving life prison sentences in the Maryland system for crimes like murder and more on the verge of release or being released?
In 2012, the Maryland Court of Appeals held unconstitutional a jury instruction that was routinely given, actually it was given in all the cases in Maryland in the 1960s and 1970s, and they made the decision retroactive, so it applied to anybody who was still locked up from trials in the 1960s and 70s. And to understand this, you have to understand first that this was not technical error. This was not some problem with the phraseology of a reasonable doubt instruction. This instruction told jurors, as remarkable as it seems today, that they were the judges of the law. And whatever the judge said to them about the law was advisory. That when it came to finding what the law was and applying the law in the case before the jury, they were the judges. Now, that instruction came from a bygone time when the colonial leaders used it to control and trump the Tory judges who were sitting and adjudicating criminal cases in Maryland and in the colonies. By the 60s and 70s, Maryland was the only state in the country that still had that instruction. So we begin with the assumption that these trials, there's no reliability to these trials. You can't trust the results of these trials because the jurors were making up the legal rules.
So the Maryland State Court of Appeals overturned this law around jury instruction when?
In 1980, the Maryland Court of Appeals, in effect, said that instruction's unconstitutional, but that ruling was prospective. It applied only in the future. In 2012, the court said, no, actually that ruling applies retroactively.
And is that being appealed to the Supreme Court?
No. The Maryland Court of Appeals is the final adjudicator of state law, and this provision is in the Maryland Constitution.
So this could literally affect – that ruling could affect any number of cases from the 60s and 70s.
There are approximately 200 people who were locked up and serving life sentences. I would emphasize life with parole sentences coming out of those trials in the 60s and the 70s and who were still in prison.
But the ability to get parole was nullified.
In 1993 and 1994, the parole of lifers virtually ended. Lifers with parole.
Now, when we saw the newspaper headlines here that came out after these 13 men were released, we turned to Walter Lomax before we turned to Russell Butler. The headlines were 13 murders released after court ruling.
Yes, and it sounded sinister, to be quite honest, Mark, and we were very, very displeased with the manner in which the Sun paper reported on those decisions. The fact is that these people have served their time. They've changed their lives. They're not a threat to public safety. Deservingly, they should have been punished for their crimes. But seeking revenge helps no one, not the victims nor society. The victims cannot heal, and society pays for it. Now, I know firsthand what this is like. My young brother was murdered in 1982, and my grandson was murdered in 2006. And my family is still angry and bitter about those losses. I, on the other hand, believe that the people responsible for their death were not in their right minds when they committed those crimes. And if they are remorseful and have changed their lives, they are deserving to be given a second chance. Now, the people being released under the Unger decision has a network of organizations assisting them with their reentry. The University of Maryland has hired a social worker to work with them and their families, and we have assembled an advisory committee to work with them. And we are planning a town hall meeting for September the 28th here at Morgan State University, hosted by Dr. Anna McFadden, the dean of the social work department, where Professor Mike Miller will be our keynote speaker, because we believe that until and unless society really understands the nature of this decision, there will be those opposing sides. And, you know, once again, if folk committed the crimes, they deserve to be punished for it. But when we move from punishment to revenge, I think that as a society, right, we are not moving in the right direction.
So, and Russell Butler may bring into this conversation. I mean, this is the immediate reaction from many people seeing this was, how could men like this be let out of prison? That's the first reaction many citizens would have. And you have opposed this decision.
Well, I don't know if we've opposed it. We feel that it's very problematic, especially in terms of justice. Justice should be justice for all and not any particular people. And victims have been left out of the process. Many of these cases come before there were victims' rights laws, and a lot of these offenders have been released without the victims, and for homicide, obviously, that means the survivors of the victim, knowing what was going on, having an opportunity to be informed, present, heard. So it's been very problematic of dealing with the very unusual retroactive application that was imposed by the court in this case.
So, now what about that question? Some people have been saying, Mike Miller, that victims were not allowed to speak, that they were not notified about this.
What I understand about what the state's attorney's office did in these cases is they used their best efforts to try to locate the survivors of the victims.
Was it all Baltimore City or was it more than that?
All Baltimore City cases.
All Baltimore City cases.
Now, keep in mind, these cases were – they go back as far as 1965. These guys have been locked up 35, 40, 45 years, and trying to trace the survivors of a victim can be, you know, very problematic over that period of time. But I will say this, that the victims that there were victims who showed up in the at least the second round of cases, and they gave, I thought, very moving testimony about the lingering effects, the second and third generational damage of homicide. We don't deny the injury to the survivors of the victims. And if you listen to that testimony, what you heard is that injury continues today. So this is not, from my perspective, this is not a contest between guys who've served 40 years. And, you know, let me give you one example of one of the guys. 40 years, went in without a high school education, got his GED, went to college, quote-unquote, on the Pell Grant, got a bachelor's degree, did his master's degree, never had a disciplinary infraction in 42 years. This man was ready to go, and he should have been paroled years ago.
But he was convicted of what?
Murder.
In a robbery or just?
It was a robbery, yeah.
So the question
– most of these are felony murders.
When I read the paper, that's what came through. So the questions are like, and I mean, like our listeners to wrestle this with us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We're talking about men, and in some cases women right now, men who have been serving life in prison, being released. And I'm curious as to your thoughts about what a justice system means. Where does it live, and how do we define that? And what are your thoughts about these men being released? 410-319-8888. Many of you have, our listeners here, have been victims of crime. Many of you have relatives who have been murdered. Many of you have relatives who are doing time in prison, friends in prison. It's a very complex question. What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. Many of you have neither, but you have thoughts on the issue. I want to hear what you think. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So what, Russell, you use the word justice. What does justice mean in situations? Well, what are we talking about when we, you know, some of these cases, I'll let you jump right into it, Russell. Some of the cases I read about were a couple people who were released were not convicted of pulling a trigger. They were either sitting outside waiting in a car. They were at the scene of the robbery. One had a gun, but there was no proof that he ever fired a gun. But was given life imprisonment because he was part of the robbery where someone died. So I'm just, you know, so I'm curious what we mean by, give us a sense of what justice means in this society.
Well,
Russell?
I think Mike said it very well when he described how some of the survivors feel that these murders still impact them today. They've lost their loved ones. They've lost a life. They have a life sentence in that they have lost their loved one for life. It's not going away. There's no way to undo a murder. And murder and rape are some of the most serious crimes. And if you do the crime, sometimes you have to pay the time. This question is not about rehabilitation. This is not, these people are being paroled or pardoned or being released because they've done well. We still have a parole system. I will say that our organization, Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center, when it was the Stephanie Roper Committee, when there was a move around the country where a lot of states abolished parole, we said, no, parole is a good thing for certain people. Most people are going to get out of jail. Most people should be rehabilitated. They should be able to come out in society and do better. But that's not the question in this case. Unfortunately, what's happened in this case is there was a problem with these jury instructions. And the jury instructions came back to the time where people didn't trust the judicial system. So they were basically allowed to nullify the crimes. This was for the benefit of those who were charged with crimes, that they would be able, that the juries would say, no, we're going to nullify this. This shouldn't be a crime. You shouldn't be punished for this. And it allowed jury nullification. And now it's been turned on its head and said, well, you didn't get the right constitutional, the federal government has required this, and so the state needs to conform its constitution. So, yes, it was wrong. We actually think that the dissent had a better view in this case. We accept the majority, but is it a change of judge? You have a judge who was in the minority for 30 years on this, and then a retired judge brought back, made this ruling, and it's caused an upheaval of these cases. So those victims who think that there's finality, cases are over, the person who has killed their loved one is being punished, now have to deal with these. So you have a lot of emotional, you have to deal with the post-traumatic stress. It's not an easy question, but the question is not one of rehabilitation or punishment. It is what happened, which should stay happen, or should we now have to deal with these cases? Well, we have to because the court has said so, but that doesn't make life easy.
No, it doesn't make life easy, but Mike, let me let you respond, then we'll open the phones here.
We have to go back to the context of these trials to understand the effect of the instruction. The instruction that the jurors decided the law was given in cases in which routinely all the African Americans were stricken from juries. It wasn't until 1985 that the Supreme Court said you can't strike jurors based on race. 24 of the 25 guys who've come to Baltimore City Circuit Court are African Americans. The racial composition of Baltimore City in 1960 census was majority white. 24 of the 25 people who have come to court so far are black. So you have all white juries, particularly outside of Baltimore City, or predominantly white juries in Baltimore City, trying African Americans, with all the African Americans stricken from the juries, at least outside Baltimore City. And then you tell the jury that they can make up the legal rules. Now, the two fundamental predicates of our system are that, number one, the defendant is presumed innocent, and number two, the state has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. When the jury can make up the rules, they can disregard those rules, and I'm sure in these cases many did.
Let me open the phones here, and then we'll come back to bring Walter back in. 410-319-8888. Greg, you're on the air. Greg, could you turn your phone down? You're on the air.
We'll come back to you. Back.
Greg, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Could you turn down your phone, please? I mean, your radio?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to ask, and I apologize for getting the young man's name. The man is on the phone. And this may be a little bit off, you know, the focus that you kind of on, but when we think about individuals, you know, serving their time, and whatever the legislative intent was for life at the time, you know, these things were kind of brought to bear. But the question basically looks at when the parole commission says that individuals are ready to come home, and then the system, based on what the governor has authority to do, says no. So he has systematically usurped the power based on the body that is impaneled to make the decision based on information that they're given. So my question basically is, you know, what do you think about that part of the process when you talk about justice, when you talk about individuals who met all the requirements to reform themselves and to rehabilitate themselves and to, you know, redeem themselves to the level that they can? How does that equate into the process, you know, of justice?
That's a really good question. Walter, you want to jump in on that? Then we'll...
It is a good question, and you're absolutely correct about the parole process. And the reality is that the majority of the people that have been released and some that are scheduled to be released would have been paroled. But because in 1995, when the former governor said that life means life, and another important fact to really consider is that a lot of these folk were very young. In fact, some of them were actually juveniles when they went to prison. And also some being convicted under the felony murder statute that did not actually commit the crime but was a part of it, the crime that was committed. And so, I mean, there's a lot of things to really take under consideration. You know, and the reality is that the victims, family members, and friends should be heard. You know, I spoke earlier about the loss of my younger brother and my grandson being murdered in Baltimore. And my family, you know, they feel that pain. They feel, you know, they really feel, and they're still very, very angry and bitter. But, you know, again, I think at some point, you know, society, we need to move away from being revengeful and think in terms of being more forgiving, you know. And if a person has changed their lives, is remorseful for what they've done, I just generally personally think that they should be given another chance.
So is there any question before we go to the next caller? Is there any question about and I'll need to turn the mic and then go to Russell's very quickly. Is there any question about innocence or guilt with any of these men?
Yes, I think there is. Here's the premise. The premise is that you can't trust the results of trials where the jury makes up the legal rules. So let's put it this way. I don't have any confidence in the adjudications of guilt. And I've seen some cases in which I think that there actually is factual innocence. I mean, innocence comes in different forms. There's factual innocence. He wasn't the guy at the scene of the crime. There is legal innocence in the sense that he's convicted of something he wasn't guilty of. He might have been guilty of manslaughter, but he wasn't guilty of murder. And when you look at these cases, I see a lot of either factual or legal innocence, at least in some of these cases. And I have no confidence in the results in the others.
Russell, your thought before we go to break here.
Well, historically, governors were able to pardon, and pardon was to forgive. And it became political, and governors didn't want to do that. So many states created parole commissions to have a process where you would have somebody make a recommendation And that's what we have in Maryland for life sentences. The parole commission can make a recommendation, and the governor can choose to accept it or not to accept it. So life meant life is a philosophy, and that is a governor exercising his or her discretion. And Governor Glendening, Governor Ehrlich, Governor O'Malley have all dealt with these in different ways. So we haven't changed the system. In fact, if there was a change in the system, the legislation was passed a couple years ago that says if the governor didn't rule in 180 days after there was a recommendation, they would be released. So we have accountability. It's the historic accountability. In fact, it's a lot easier to get out with a parole commission than without them. So I think there's some misunderstanding about the whole concept of parole and a change. So, you had a governor making an interpretation. Parole was not eliminated.
We have to take a break, and I'll let Mike come back, then we go to Afrikaner, our next caller up. Join us here, 410-319-8888. We'll get your calls as well. Don't go away. We're back as we wrestle with the question of the men being released from Maryland State prisons because of faulty jury instructions 30 years ago and what it says also about those men. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are wrestling with the decision by this Court of Appeals to release to release as many as 200 prisoners convicted before 1980 of crimes, including murder and other crimes, because of the jury instructions that actually gave the juries the right, a greater rights than the judge to determine what happens to these men. And so we are here with Michael Milliman, who's the Jacob A. France Professor of Public Interest Law and Director of the Leadership, Ethics, and Democracy Initiative at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, who is one of the leading attorneys in this case. Walter Lomax is with us again in the studio. He's been joined us numerous times before. Walter Lomax is the director of an organization, the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, advocating for humane sentencing policies for prisoners serving long sentences. And Russell Butler is with us, executive director of the Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center. And you're with us at 410-319-8888. And Mike and Walter, you want to have a quick say, then we'll go to our next caller.
I just got to make a comment about the change in the parole policy. There's a radical change in the parole policy in this state in 1993. Most of the guys, or I'd say half of the guys who got released, were in work release in 1993 on their way out of the system, headed towards parole because they'd earned it. It used to be that if you served 15, 20 years and you did what you were supposed to do and you showed you weren't dangerous, you got paroled in large numbers. And the radical change is that modern-day governors, particularly two Democrats, basically stopped paroling people, absent extraordinary circumstances.
Glendening and O'Malley.
Yeah. Right. It basically stopped approving paroles, and I think it derives from the Willie Horton affair during the Bush-Dukakis debate, where Dukakis got hammered with the guy who walked off of work release in Massachusetts. So there's been a dramatic change in the parole policy, the parole practice.
And Walter, you want to have a say on this, then we'll go open the phones?
Yes. Mr. Butler is absolutely correct. In fact, our organization, the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, advocated for that legislation that was passed in 2011, giving the governor 180 days to make a decision or a recommendation that comes before his office. However, what the governor summarily did was denied well over 50 petitions that was before his office for recommendation in 2011. And in 2012, no one was serving a parole-eligible life sentence was recommended for parole, a clear indication that politics still plays a role in this process.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And Afrikaan, you're on the air. Hello, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is African. I am from Africa. Are you there?
We're listening to you.
This is to awaken the people. There's three parts to this system. Executive, that's the government. Legislative, that's the Congress. And judiciary, that's central booking. Now, where's black people's system or African people's system? Can anybody answer that question?
Well,
not our system.
All right, just finish what you were saying, rather than ask questions. What are you saying? Okay. Sorry. But let's talk about what the system does and what it means and what it should be. I mean, when we say, and I was thinking about what happened in Norway. Remember that horrendous murder of all those children at this camp in Norway. And so after the trial, he was convicted and was given what was a maximum sentence, which was 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
That he could be kept in for life, depending on what the judicial system feels after 20 years, but he was given these 20 years. He can't get out before 20 years, but and he might be held longer. But it's interesting the way we look at questions of justice and rehabilitation and justice and punishment and what they mean. So just in a larger philosophical question here about who we are as a nation, what we think our justice system should be, I'd like all of you to kind of comment on that for a moment before we have to move on. Mike, and then we'll go to Rustin and then over to Walter.
A quick comment. The United States of America has the longest prison sentences in the world. We lock people up for longer than any other democratic government in the rest of the world. And if you look at the data, we're usually, when it comes to our punishment practices, the people who are comparable to us on the list are Iraq, Iran, China, et cetera. The notion that we don't lock people up long enough is just not a notion that anybody else in the civilized world accepts. So there's been some recent movement to begin to move away from mandatory sentences, to move away from the length of sentences. But that's because we can't afford to pay all the costs of incarceration.
Russell Butler?
Well, I think in terms of your question about justice, justice to me means fairness, and fairness means fairness for all. And I think we've gone a long way in our country, and if you look at the recent statutes that have been passed in Maryland, you can be released for DNA. You can be released for actual innocence. Clearly, there are some people who were convicted improperly, and there were some people who were acquitted properly. There's no question that the system is not perfect. But with this case, what I would say is there's no prejudice required. It's sort of a per se. If you were convicted, it appears that you are going to either have a new trial, or in a lot of cases, apparently, they've been allowed to plead guilty and get credit for time served and be on probation. So this is not an individual determination. This is because there was an error without necessarily the proof of any prejudice.
Walter Lomax.
Well, the reality here is that the majority of these people would have been released on parole. I mean, we continue to lock more and more people up and ask that they spend longer and longer periods incarcerated as if locking up people is going to make us safe. The reality is that once a person clearly has rehabilitated themselves and has changed their life and are no longer a threat to public safety, it becomes senseless just to continue to warehouse them in prisons where we as taxpayers pay for them to remain there. And so the as long as politics remain a part of this process, and as Mike mentioned, folk who are threatened by the Willie Horton syndrome and refuse to do what the right thing is, and that is, right, to reasonably consider these folk for release. We're not talking about open the floodgates and let everybody out of prison. And these folk that are being released, as Mike said, you can't rely on the verdict based on the instructions that was given by the to the jury at that particular point in time. And just in closing, again, if these people had have been if politics wasn't a part of the process, these people would have been released on parole many, many years ago, and we wouldn't be having this discussion. And to talk now in terms of the fact that they were wrongfully convicted and to say that they are being released as a result of that is really not the issue. The issue is that they've long earned the right to be at least reasonably considered for release. And so now that they are being released, our task is to make sure, one, is that they have the right correct support system and to assist them in their reentry into society, because these are basically the same people that we've advocated on for many, many years. And had they been released under the natural course, because they were entitled to meaningful consideration for parole, they would already be back into society, and we wouldn't be having this conversation.
We have an email here from Lauren, who wrote in, I'm one of the social workers who has been working with the newly released prisoners at the Mentoring Academy, a project of living classrooms. I have experienced them as humble, contrite, grateful for any help, and completely harmless. They deserve another chance, writes in Lauren, one of the social workers working with these men. This is a very tough question for many people to deal with and to address on lots of levels, emotionally, just in terms of people being released from prison for murders. When we talk about, let's just close this out. I was thinking about something. I haven't been involved with restorative justice on the show a lot in terms of our conversations, but what that means. Has there been any thought to, if victims' families want to having conversations between these men being released and the people's lives they affected?
You know, I think that's a really interesting idea. And maybe, Russell, we could talk about this afterwards. In the court, there have been at least two or three prisoners who, after the victim survivors testified, turned around, and one guy with tears streaming down his face and said, I am so sorry. It was a dramatic courtroom apology, and you could tell that it was utterly sincere. He didn't rehearse it. He didn't come to court expecting to say it. But, and this has happened now several times. And I think it would be interesting to see if for victim survivors who are interested, I mean, I certainly wouldn't impose it on anybody, to see if there's a way of having some conversations, because I think it would break down what would feel like artificial walls.
An email came in. I'll let Russell let you have a final thought here, but we have to really break in about a minute here because we have our other guests waiting outside to come in. Rebecca wrote in, please ask the University of Maryland Law School if they confirm by other states, U.S. data, that the primary determinant of a sentence is the race of a victim. We did talk about that a bit. We can count on one hand the number of parole lifers in Maryland approved by a parole board, defined, denied by government, and life sentence for murder in California is 7 years. Jury nullification was created in case defendants were found not guilty. And it was a comment from Rebecca. But very quickly, Russell, what would you say back to Mike Milliman before we have to close out?
Well, number one, I think that what Mike and Walter are doing are extraordinary. They're trying to help people that need help. And I have no ill will. I wish all of these people who are being released the best. I don't think it's an us versus them. And I agree with Mike. There are some victims who want that. We would clearly support facilitating that. We believe in restorative justice. And I don't think we may disagree about the holding of this case, but I don't think either of us disagree in terms of trying to make whatever the system is now the best.
I want to thank all of you for being here. Russell Butler, who's executive director of the Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center. Walter Lomax, who joins us once again in our studio, the executive director and founder of Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, advocates for humane sentencing policies for prisoners and serving long sentences, and Mike Milliman, who's a Jacob A. France Professor of Public Interest Law and Director of the Leadership, Ethics, and Democracy Initiative at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Michael Milliman, Russell Butler, Walter Lomax, thank you all so much.
Great to be here.
Yes, thank you, Mark.
We'll take a brief break.
Thank
you very much. We'll take a brief break. We're going to meet the young men who are putting together the Black Caucus Film Festival. Stay with us.